From Pacifica Reporters Against Censorship, this is Free Speech Radio News for Tuesday, November 25, 2003. From Pacifica Station WBAI in New York City, I'm Amma Bouadi. Today is International Day Opposing Violence Against Women, and to mark the occasion, we look at how women are fighting for their rights in Colombia. Kashmiri separatist parties agree to unconditional talks with India, and we look at the excessive force used by the Miami police to stifle peaceful protest during last week's FTAA meetings. But first, these news headlines.
I'm Randy Zimmerman with the headlines for Free Speech Radio News. The United States Senate passed the Medicare bill critics claim leads to the privatization of medical provisions for the nation's senior citizens. President Bush promises to sign the bill into law that carries a much sought-after measure to cover prescription drugs. Many agree if not seniors, the bill will surely help drug manufacturers and insurance companies who helped create and heavily lobbied for the bill. And the U.S. Congress struck a deal with White House officials that would allow media conglomerates to increase the amount of television stations they may own. Mitch Jeserich has more from Capitol Hill.
The U.S. Congress has backed down in its standoff with President Bush over media ownership rules. During the summer, Congress voted to reverse the FCC's rule change that would have lifted the TV station ownership cap from 35% to 45%. Now Congress is reconsidering its stance due to a Bush veto threat and is proposing to lift the cap to 39%. John Schwartz is with Free Speech Television.
Any raising in that cap is a bad thing. Now, if there's a silver lining, it's that the public did rise up. This was going to go to 45% in what I think was intended to be a fairly obscure inside-the-beltway rulemaking exploded into a national issue.
Lifting the TV ownership cap from 35% to 39% would be a victory for media conglomerates such as Viacom, which owns Fox and CBS. If the cap is left at 35%, then Viacom would be forced to sell off some of its stations. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Mitch Jeserich in Washington.
Today, Southern California grocery workers extend their pickets to Northern California supermarkets. Monica Lopez reports from KPFK.
The move comes a day after Teamsters joined the strike by refusing to make deliveries to Southern California Vons, Ralph's, and Albertson's stores during the Thanksgiving shopping week. According to Greg Denier, national spokesperson for the United Food and Commercial Workers, about 70,000 workers are either on strike or locked out, affecting nearly 900 stores in the Southland. Today's new picket lines, made up of Southern California workers, extend from the state's Central Valley north to the Oregon border. Clerks went on strike against Vons on October 11th. Other union workers were then immediately locked out of their jobs at Albertsons and Ralph's. The central issue is health care coverage offered by the Kroger Company, owner of the Ralph's chain, and Vons, owner of Safeway and Albertsons. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Monica Lopez in Los Angeles.
A Canadian citizen who was released from the U.S. naval base prison at Guantanamo Bay in late October says Canada is denying him re-entry home. Reporting from CKLN in Toronto, Kristen Schwartz.
Abdul Rahman Al-Qadr is a Canadian citizen who grew up in Toronto. As a teenager, his parents took him to Afghanistan, where he was arrested in late 2001 alongside his younger brother. Both were eventually transferred to Camp X-Ray at Guantanamo Bay. In late October, he was released from Camp X-Ray. U.S. authorities say that Canada refused to accept him. He called his grandmother in Toronto last week and reported that he was left in Afghanistan with no money or identification, and that Canadian consular offices in Pakistan and Turkey have refused to give him a passport. Under pressure from the family's lawyer and the media, Canada's Department of Foreign Affairs is now saying that Mr. Qadr is free to return to Canada. His family, however, remains afraid for his safety. This is Kristen Schwartz from CKLN in Toronto.
The City Council in Cambridge, Massachusetts, voted unanimously to become the first municipal government in the state to endorse marriage rights for same-sex couples. Dave Goodman reports from Boston.
Last week, the Massachusetts Supreme Judicial Court decided it was unconstitutional for the state to deny same-sex couples the right to marry and all the accompanying benefits. The court gave the state legislature 6 months to craft legislation that would extend marriage rights to these couples. But barely 24 hours after the court ruled, several Cambridge city councilors drafted a local ordinance instructing the city clerk to take steps to remove all barriers to equal marriage and issue licenses as soon as possible. Counselor Denise Simmons, who says justice deferred is justice denied, argued that Cambridge needs to be ready long before the court's deadline.
There's a lot of things that the city of Cambridge can and should do so that we can be ready should something happen and that we can move forward before the 180 days that the state legislature changes its mind, backs off, moves proactively, that we can then be ready.
But following debate over the city's jurisdiction and whether or not this order would be merely symbolic, the councilors voted unanimously to accept the order as long as the words "as soon as possible" were changed to "when legally possible." For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Dave Goodman in Cambridge, Massachusetts.
And I'm Randy Zimmerman for Free Speech Radio News.
To commemorate International Day Opposing Violence Against Women, a caravan of nearly 3,000 women from across Colombia culminated today in the southernmost state of Putumayo, a region that since 2000 has been the focal point of aerial fumigations under the U.S.-financed program Plan Colombia. The past 3 years of fumigations intended to eradicate coca crops, the base used to make cocaine, and has caused the Colombian people to suffer hunger, displacement, health problems, loss of land, and severe militarization. Both the US and Colombian governments refuse to recognize the human environmental detriment that their anti-narcotic program continues to cause. And that is why thousands of Colombian women have risked traveling heavy conflict areas to join together to protest these fumigations. Nicole Carson reports from Bogota.
Chanting that women can make peace, three busloads of women left Bogota on Sunday night, joining with 90 other buses in what they call the Ruta Pacifica, or the Pacific Route. Today, around 3,000 women arrived at their final destination, the Amazon state of Putumayo, to protest the U.S.-Colombian policy of aerial fumigations using an herbicide called glyphosate with the objective of killing coca plants, but with the reality of killing most everything in its wake, causing a humanitarian crisis for hundreds of thousands of Colombians who inhabit rural areas. Maria Eugenia Sanchez, who works with the Ruta Pacifica in Colombia's capital.
The mobilization makes a strong denouncement about the impacts of fumigations, not only on people's health, but on the environment as well.
Because the fumigations indiscriminately hit food crops, thousands of families in the countryside are facing hunger, and they are forced to move to the cities. In Mocoa, the capital of Putumayo, there are approximately 12,000 people who have been displaced because of fumigations. Despite this, the Colombian government does not recognize that fumigations are causing displacement and therefore does not assist families forced to flee fumigated lands. Fatima Morial lives in Mocoa and works with the Community Women's Council. She says she is very pleased the Pacific Route will attract attention to the suffering the fumigations cause, but Morial is concerned because the government has no plan to terminate the spraying in Putumayo or in any other part of Colombia.
The quantity of displaced families and people living in conditions of misery is totally unrecognized by the government. We never had this in Putumayo before, but the fumigations and the anti-narcotic policy is finishing off the social fabric. It is totally destroyed.
According to a recent study conducted by the Andean Services Committee in Ecuador, women who live on the Colombian-Ecuadorian border and who have been subjected to fumigations face a higher risk of cancer, genetic damage for those who are pregnant, and suffer damage to their blood cells. Analyst Marcela Ceballos from the Colombian Coordination of Displaced Peoples and Human Rights.
Los resultados del estudio alarman sobre los derechos reproductivos de la mujer.
The results of the study are alarming in respect to reproductive rights of women and how the fumigations, the strategy of forced eradication, are generating long-term effects in health and the rights of indigenous peoples. It is important to ask the U.S. Congress for an independent report not only about the effects of health and the environment, but also about the political effects on national stability and democracy caused by the military strategy of Plan Colombia.
Arauca, the northeastern province of Colombia that borders Venezuela, was the most recent target of fumigations that began in September. The peasant farmers who subsist on their yuca and plantain crops are already facing hunger. On paper, one component of Plan Colombia is an indemnization program that repays families for damages caused by the spraying. However, of the 8,000 complaints that the U.S. Embassy has received, only 2 cases have been repaid. According to the Center for International Policy, the U.S. has given Colombia $2.44 billion in aid during the past 3 years, 80% of which is allotted to the military and fumigations. Even though more than 600,000 acres of coca were sprayed from 2000 to 2002, at the same time, the amount of coca grown in Colombia increased by 6%. From Bogota, I'm Nicole Carson for Free Speech Radio News.
Last week, thousands of peaceful protesters from 50 states and several countries gathered in Miami, Florida to voice their opposition to the corporate globalization model espoused by proponents of a free trade area of the Americas. But they were met by thousands of heavily armed police from 40 counties and several federal agencies carrying rubber bullets, pepper spray and much more. As one officer told FSRN, the protesters came to speak and the police came to drown you out. WORT's Norm Stockwell was there and files this report.
Activists from across the United States, as well as many countries of Latin America, gathered in Miami, Florida last week to raise their voices against the model of corporate globalization represented by the so-called free trade area of the Americas, and particularly its U.S. proponents. Thursday was the main day of demonstrations, with several marches scheduled, the first assembling before 7 a.m. Amidst the sound of circling helicopters, marchers headed toward downtown Miami, where meetings were scheduled to begin in the Intercontinental Hotel, surrounded by high fences with entrances bearing names like Checkpoint Bravo. Police blocked the progress of the march and ultimately isolated and divided the demonstrators into smaller groupings, an occurrence that continued to play out throughout the day. Protesters were beaten, gassed, shot with rubber bullets and pepper pellets, and driven into some of Miami's poorest neighborhoods. Over 150 people were arrested during the day. Friday afternoon, a peaceful group of around 300 assembled outside Miami's courthouse and jail detention center. As protesters peacefully sang and chanted, the group was surrounded by police in riot gear. Longtime anti-war activist Tom Hayden, veteran of the Chicago 7 conspiracy trial, describes the scene.
On the other side of the street, you have the consequence of too much law and order. You have grown men overburdened with massive amounts of useless police equipment.
Shortly after 5 p.m., the police declared the assembly unlawful, gave the demonstrators 3 minutes to clear the area, and then began moving in rapidly. The police drove a wedge between the groups who were beginning to disperse and pushed about 24 against a fence, which toppled to the ground. All were arrested for unlawful assembly and resisting by fleeing, a contradiction that was repeatedly pointed out by the public defenders during the next day's bail bond hearings. One of those arrested was Democracy Now! Producer Ana Nogueira, who was wearing a prominently displayed press credential while filming the event.
A line of riot cops cut us off and pushed us into a corner, pushed us on the ground, sprayed us, beat some people. I was filming the whole time. They were kind of uncertain as to what to do with me until one officer said, "No, she's not with us, she's not with us," as I was trying to say that I'm with the press, I'm with the press, which implied that I was not an embedded journalist and therefore arrestable.
78 people were arrested in this sweep, many kept in small vans with tight plastic handcuffs for up to 10 hours before being moved to a large detention facility northwest of the airport and an expensive cab ride from downtown. Here, many had their clothing removed and destroyed, ostensibly because it was soaked with pepper spray. Many never got their one phone call, and almost all were released after a probable cause hearing the following day found little or no evidence of need for their arrest. Over 273 arrests took place during the week in Miami, and now in the aftermath, groups are gathering stories and information in anticipation of upcoming lawsuits against the city, police department, and individual officers. Lita Rodriguez-Tassif, president of the Greater Miami Chapter of the Florida ACLU, explains.
We do anticipate lawsuits against all of the above. We anticipate that the lawsuits will be brought in the name of people who were walking peacefully. We've got journalists. We've got union members, all who had their Fourth Amendment rights completely stripped during the last week.
Miami's police chief John Timoney, veteran of the police repression of protesters at the Philadelphia Republican Convention in 2000, was hired to prepare for the FTAA meetings. His tone and his style echoed throughout the weekend, and Timoney himself, who shares his family name with the type of Irish armored personnel carrier, the Timoney, will no doubt be a party in many of these suits. Randall Marshall, legal director of the ACLU of Florida.
The fact that the chief of police himself is setting the tone for the department shows why things went wrong. It's no surprise that there are complaints coming in as a result of police tactics last week.
Stories are still being gathered at ACLUFL at ACLUFL.org. For Free Speech Radio News from WORT Community Radio, this is Norman Stockwell.
More than 300 members of the Great Sioux Nation converged on Rapid City, South Dakota last weekend for a two-day conference aimed at establishing a united front in fighting for their treaty rights. Called Awakening the Sovereign Spirit of a Great Lakota Nation, the gathering brought together elders who have been pursuing treaty rights for decades with a new generation of warriors who plan to take their battle to the halls of Congress. Jim Kent attended the gathering, which one Lakota elder dubbed the do-or-die of treaty conferences, and filed this report.
Certainly the federal government needs to keep in mind always that Native American programs are not discretionary programs in the sense that many programs for the rest of the country are, that they are unique because many of them are premised on treaty obligations.
South Dakota U.S. Senator Tim Johnson is one of a handful of congressional representatives who actually uses the word treaty when discussing Native Americans. For the Lakota tribes, also known as the Great Sioux Nation, their key treaties were signed with the United States at Fort Laramie, Wyoming Territory, in 1851 and in 1868. Contrary to what's inferred in most history books, the treaties were not terms of surrender. They were, in fact, documents requested by a federal government that could no longer afford to wage a losing battle of guerrilla warfare against Native American tribes across the country. In fact, by the middle of the 19th century, campaigns against the tribes, America's first Vietnam, were costing the U.S. close to $1 million for each Native American killed.
They say we're incompetent to their laws. My people aren't incompetent. They're smart. If there's anybody that's incompetent to their laws, it's a federal government. They can't even listen to their own or abide by their own U.S. Constitution. Treaties are supreme law.
As moderator Harvey Whitewoman pointed out during the Great Sioux Nation's two-day treaty meeting in Rapid City, the federal government has a propensity of not only breaking treaties with the Sioux and other Indian tribes, but also for breaking its own constitution. According to Article 6 of the U.S. Constitution, quote, "Treaties are the supreme law of the land," end quote. Every time Washington passes legislation that violates a treaty, it violates the Constitution, and that concerns Lakota elder Oliver Red Cloud.
Today we have a lot of people that are concerned about their rights and a generation that come. And reason why we're here, the way they're going on today, we're going to lose our treaty rights. They're going to take over our land.
But if it's been frustrating seeing their treaties broken by the federal government, and it has, members of the Great Sioux Nation are equally upset with their own tribal governments. Oliver Red Cloud, great-grandson of the legendary Chief Red Cloud, says that since tribal governments were established by the federal government with the Indian Reorganization Act of 1934, they really have no authority to negotiate treaty issues. Because of this, Red Cloud notes, tribal governments frequently agree to legislation that violates their own treaties with the federal government, so negotiating any treaty issues should fall with treaty councils made up of tribal members who are not part of the federally mandated tribal governments.
They're the one make the treaty, not the treaty in the tribe, because that's just start 1935, and they have no treaty.
To avoid further misrepresentation of their treaties, Harvey Whitewoman says a resolution was passed during the treaty meeting establishing a working group to revitalize the Oshete Shakaween, the seven council fires of the Great Sioux Nation, as one voice. Tribal governments, notes Whitewoman, need to take a back seat from now on.
And that's not only our treaty, not our tribal governments, but all tribal governments, whatever organizations are out there as far as treaties, they must be subordinate to it. And I don't mean that to offend them, but they must be subordinate because the treaty is supreme law.
The new warriors of the Great Sioux Nation will hold their next meeting on December 13th at the Bear Butte Lodge. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Jim Kent in Rapid City, South Dakota.
Guatemalans voted in droves 2 weeks ago in the country's second presidential election since 1996 when the peace accords that ended a 36-year civil war were signed. The losing candidates included the governing party's Efraín Ríos Montt, a retired general who ruled Guatemala as a dictator for 18 months in the early 1980s. But as Chip Mitchell reports from Guatemala City, it's far from clear if either candidate in a December 28 runoff would take steps to reduce Guatemala's crushing poverty.
Here in the central market of the capital, Julio Reynaud uses a sewing machine to assemble traditional clothing he sells to tourists. Tourism has taken over coffee as Guatemala's biggest industry, but he says business is down due to a boom in drug trafficking and violent crime.
Nuestro Guatemala necesitamos un gobierno que realmente caiga paz.
Our country needs a government that brings peace and prosperity. Many governments promise such things without providing them.
The mostly Mayan inhabitants of this Central American country are mired in deep poverty and the effects of a war that killed 200,000 people. Their frustration spurred a 70% voter turnout in the election's first round, held November 9th amid a campaign season unprecedented for its violence. The violence continued on election day amid long lines at polling places and a chaotic registration process. Since then, about a dozen local protests have demanded new elections for mayor. In San Martin Jilotepeque, 2 hours northwest of the capital, a November 13th protest turned into a riot that injured dozens. A rancher named Antonio Roca ran for mayor for Rios Montt's party. He says the riot was spontaneous.
The people of San Martin are very upset about the election results because many people weren't allowed to vote. They protested because they oppose this mayor.
Many other residents blame the violence on the defeated candidates. An 18-year-old ice cream vendor says she saw a candidate's brother going door-to-door that morning.
Everyone in town knows him and knows he's a troublemaker. They said they were going to kill the mayor and his whole family the day he started his second term.
These clashes notwithstanding, fears of mass violence have not materialized. Miguel Ángel Sandoval leads the labor program of the Human Rights Legal Action Center, Guatemala's most influential non-governmental group. He says the election brought three positive changes.
First is the electoral defeat of Ríos Montt, who represents the past, who represents counterinsurgency, authoritarianism, and genocide. Second, we're going to have a Congress in which no party has a majority. This pluralism opens possibilities for legislative transparency and something new for the country, political debate. The third thing about the election was a level of citizen participation.
Sandoval says he'd like the next president to redistribute land to some of the 300,000 coffee workers whose jobs have disappeared in recent years. Human rights advocates say other crucial measures would include cutting the military budget, hiking spending on health and education, and protecting local producers from food imports flooding Guatemala. But such steps don't seem to interest either of the December 28th runoff candidates. The frontrunner, former Guatemala City Mayor Oscar Berchet, is a rancher backed by the nation's traditional elite, especially sugar and coffee interests. His opponent, textile businessman Alvaro Colom, led a government agency that brought in low-paying garment factories known as maquiladoras. Ronald Flores writes a column for the country's leading newspaper, Prensa Libre.
The problem with this people is that they lack the ability to perform within democracy, with the demands that democracy has placed to themselves, which is the demands of the poor people in Guatemala that are 60% of the population, and the demands of the private sector, which are 10% of the population that run the country. In a democracy, you have to be able to meet both of these sectors' demands in an efficient manner, thinking about the country in its overall benefit 20 years, 30 years down the road. Most governments in Guatemala lately have only thought about themselves in that immediate present.
Back in the central market, a vendor named Matilde Lorenzo pours black beans from a 100-pound sack onto a scale. She's been working here for 6 years since moving from Zacatepeques, a southern province where most people speak Kakchikel, one of the country's two dozen Mayan languages. You can't tell who's the best candidate, she says. God only knows. In Guatemala City, I'm Chip Mitchell.
The Kashmiri Separatist Alliance, the All Parties Hurriyat Conference, or APHC, has agreed to unconditional talks with the Indian government. The APHC made the announcement last Friday in Srinagar, 1 month after the Indian government stated that Deputy Prime Minister L.K. Advani will address the Hurriyat Conference. The Hurriyat Conference has also said that it is working on a roadmap in which it will offer a resolution of the long-standing dispute between India and Pakistan.
people offering prayers at the Grand Mosque of Srinagar in Kashmir. Chanting pro-independence slogans during the Friday prayers is almost a ritual here. A month ago, India announced that Indian Deputy Prime Minister L.K. Advani will hold talks with the Hurriyat Conference. Last week, Hurriyat Conference accepted the talks.
We have waited long for India, Pakistan, the Muslim world, and the United Nations to resolve the issue justifiably. But now we think the time has come for the Kashmiris to get up themselves.
Addressing worshippers on the last Friday of the holy month of Ramadan, Kashmir's head preacher and founder of the separatist conglomerate All Parties Hurriyat Conference, Mirwais Umar Farooq, read the resolution passed by the Hurriyat Conference. Hindustan aur Pakistan
ke darmiyan. To save the subcontinent from the disaster of nuclearization, the Kashmir issue needs to be resolved, because the basic cause of the confrontation between India and Pakistan is Kashmir. The issue needs to be addressed immediately. We stress on the people of India and Pakistan to ask their governments to work for a meaningful resolution of Kashmir's dispute for the larger good of the whole subcontinent.
Since India and Pakistan won independence from Britain more than 50 years ago, Kashmir has been a dispute between India and Pakistan. Plus, a separatist movement broke out in Kashmir in the 90s, giving birth to the All Parties Hurriyat Conference. Professor Abdul Ghani Bhatt, executive member of the Hurriyat Conference, says it has a roadmap it will offer to India and Pakistan.
We've drawn an outline for the viable and sustainable solution of the Kashmir issue. We will present this solution to the international community first and later to India and Pakistan. We'll be working more on the details, taking everyone into confidence. We will meet all the high commissioners and convey the outline to the whole of the international community.
The All Parties Hurriyat Conference, a conglomerate of around 25 parties, is the major separatist platform among the divided separatist camp in Kashmir. This year, the organization saw a major split when hardliner leader Saeed Ali Gilani created a competing Hurriyat Conference. A major voice in the community, Gilani stays away from talks, causing many to question the outcome. Sarwar Kashani is a Srinagar-based journalist.
Gilani leave aside his hardliner he is, how hardcore he is, but he definitely has a clout in the public and his voice definitely holds a weight. Unless he's not involved, I don't think that talks process would bring about any solution to the Kashmir issue.
Sarwar, however, is optimistic too.
Whether it will achieve something or not, I cannot predict that. But the thing is that it's definitely going to break the ice. Not in near future, but definitely it will pave way for a serious dialogue to resolve the Kashmir issue.
Three wars have been fought over Kashmir since 1947, and the decade-long insurgency in the region has claimed around 100,000 lives so far. As for many local residents, they hope that a decision can be reached soon and bring an end to the daily violence in Kashmir. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Shahnaz Khan in Srinagar, Kashmir.
I'm Amma Bouadi and you were listening to Free Speech Radio News. Free Speech Radio News is produced at Pacifica Station WBAI in New York, KPFA in Berkeley, and community radio station WMNF in Tampa, Florida. The newscast is produced by Katamesta, Simba Rousseau, with Aaron Glantz. Headlines editors are Randy Zimmerman and Nell Abram. Our technical production team is Jade Paget-Seekins, Pauline Bartolone, and Lindsay Benedict.